All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
I should have some time, see me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. Today we have a guest, a returning guest, Josh. Hello, Josh. Welcome.
Oh, hey. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, our pleasure. Josh, you want to talk a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Up until last week, I was the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's media critic.
Yeah.
You can find out more about that soon.
Interesting.
But, yeah. Wendy's my girl. Well, I feel like we've done a lot of stuff, and I feel like we work very well together.
Yeah, I agree. And you asked, you said, when am I coming back on the podcast?
It was really fun the first time getting to talk about a movie you hated, so I figured that we could pick one you actually liked.
Yeah, as a reference, we talked about The Birds last time, so if anybody would like to go back and revisit that episode, we'd be happy to have you do so. And if you would like to leave a review, that would be really helpful. Podcasts are rated pretty much by the reviews and so forth, things like that. So anybody that listens to podcast on Apple or iTunes. If you can leave a review, that's really helpful to the podcast, but only if it's a good one. We don't want bad reviews. And then now on YouTube. So you can also follow the podcast and subscribe on YouTube.
And if you want to learn more about Wendy, I did a nice little story on her about a month ago.
Yes.
And all of her many media endeavors.
Yes, thank you. That was very kind of you. Always good to get a... They say all press is good press, right?
Yeah, if you're going to put in the work, you'll get a story.
Yeah, nice.
This has always been my philosophy.
Well, appreciate it. So, but as far as today, we are going to get in our time machine and we are going back to 1963 and we are going to talk about...
The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
Yeah, so The Sound of Music nominated for 10 Academy Awards. It won for Best Picture, which was for Robert Wise, Best Director, also Robert Wise, Best Sound, Best Editing, and Best Score. It was nominated for Best Actress, Julie Andrews, of course, Best Supporting Actress, Peggy Wood, Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume Design.
I have notes about those if you would like to have them now.
Well, I'm going to go through the crew bit by bit, so if you want to interject at any time.
Yeah, I'm unclear about why some of those nominations happened and also unclear about why some of those wins didn't happen. It's a mixed bag. I mean, obviously, one of the more deserving Best Picture winners we've ever had. But,
well,
yeah.
We'll just start out. This is based on a Lindsay and Krauss book, The Sound of Music, that the 1959 Broadway stage musical was also based on. So Lindsay and Krauss, this is kind of an interesting genre of what they do. They are playwrights who collaborate to write books of Broadway plays. So they write an actual book about a Broadway play, and then I guess they adapt the book into the play. It's very strange. But one of the ones they did was Sound of Music, and one of the ones they did was Anything Goes. That's another musical. They also won a Pulitzer Prize for their play State of the Union. I don't think that's a musical. I would guess not.
I wouldn't assume it is.
Yeah. But they also wrote the play Life with Father, and they co-produced the play Arsenic and Old Lace, which are both really nice, funny, interesting plays.
I mean, if you have The Sound of Music on your resume, I think your musical bona fides are pretty set for life.
Yeah. Yeah, and The Sound of Music... also, we should say, was based on Maria von Trapp's 1949 memoir, The Story of the Von Trapp Family Singers, which was based on her experiences in World War II. The real Maria.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there are also at least one, maybe two German movies that were made about Maria's story before this?
And that's my...
Oh, sorry.
You're good. You're segueing me right into my next statement.
I try.
Von Trapp's memoirs were originally purchased by German producer Wolfgang Liebeniner.
Sure, let's go with that.
Liebeniner. Who created two film adaptations, 1956's The Trapp Family and the 1958 sequel, The Trapp Family in America. Very original titles.
Honestly, though, not a bad idea for a sequel, considering that's the only part of their story
yeah,
in the movie
unknown,
The Sound of Music didn't go into.
They were quite popular in Germany and a lot of Europe, not obviously very popular in America. But the screenplay was by Ernest Lehman.
Maybe Lehman.
Lehman. He was a six-time Oscar nominee, and he sadly never won, but he finally did win his honorary Oscar, the good old honorary Oscar.
The participation trophy of Oscars.
Yeah, that's almost a... Well, we're sorry we didn't give you an Oscar before, but you're old, so here you go. That's basically what it is.
Correct.
Started out as a copywriter for a Broadway publicist and a press agent, and he used his experiences in those jobs to create the novel and screenplay for The Sweet Smell of Success, which is another one of our podcasts, an excellent podcast and an excellent film. Ernest was an avid cyclist, and he would travel around Beverly Hills on his bicycle even after becoming a well-known screenwriter. He didn't bother with limousines. He was just like, jump on my bike. I can go anywhere. He actually also attempted to climb Mount Rushmore after he wrote it in his North by Northwest screenplay. He thought he'd give it a go. But then he got a little bit up there and realized he might fall. So
no wonder he ended up making a screenplay about a movie that's all about mountains. This explains so much.
Luckily, he didn't go and try to climb the Alps while he was at it, right?
I've done it before. It's doable. But I have no idea how old he was at that point.
Well, apparently, his son, John... This guy is quite a guy, okay? Because his son, Jonathan, was born when he was 86 years old.
My God. Full Pacino.
I mean, he's riding bikes. He's climbing mountains. He's
living life to the fullest.
He is. He was known for numerous films such as Sabrina, The King and I, North by Northwest, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and West Side Story. In fact, Ernest, whatever, suggested Robert Wise as the director for The Sound of Music because he worked with him in West Side Story.
As dynamic duos go.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good one.
Yep. Two great musicals. And so while Robert Wise was approached to be the director at the time, I don't know if you heard about this, he was busy on another film called The Sand Pebbles, and they were forced to look elsewhere. But so what they wound up doing was choosing William Wyler, but he did not really want to do this film. He seemed not very exciting about the subject matter, and they managed to convince him. But then as the screenplay process was going on, Ernest would suspect that Wyler was not very committed. And when Ernest sent him the first draft, he had no comments whatsoever. So Ernest was thinking, hey, this guy doesn't seem like he's all this interested. I'm a little worried about him. So he secretly sent a draft of the screenplay to Robert Wise, hoping, oh, maybe he will come and direct. And then coincidentally, Wyler approached Daryl Zanuck, who was the head of 20th Century Fox. This is the studio producing the film, asked if they could delay production so he could film something called The Collector.
Sure.
And then coincidentally, at the same time, Robert Wise's production of The Sand Pebbles was delayed. And so therefore, they swapped them out.
R.I.P. The Sand Pebbles.
Yeah. Well, it may have been made after.
Their place in history, at least.
Yeah. But they swapped out Wyler for Wise, and it all worked out.
Truly.
A little bit about director Robert Wise. He was a seven-time Oscar nominee. He won four Academy Awards, one for producer and director on West Side Story, one for producer and director on The Sound of Music.
Again, if those are the two musicals on your resume,
yeah,
and they happened within a, what, two or three year period
of
each other?
Yeah, it was a short period of time, yes.
That's just you become Hollywood royalty immediately, yeah. Especially when you end up with a movie that gets played on cable every Christmas thousand times.
Does it still, though? Because I think that Disney owns it now, and they don't let anybody play their music.
I watched it on Disney Plus, so that's possible.
Well, that's
at least while I was growing up, it seemed like it was on.
Yes, correct. It was on cable.
But also, even better, your movie's now on Disney Plus, and anybody can watch it, well, if they pay for Disney Plus.
If they have Disney Plus.
Still.
Yes. So Robert was very interested in films at a young age, and he would start at RKO Studios at age 19, doing various jobs before he was made an editor. He edited Citizen Kane. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Robert, my guy.
Yeah, editor on Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane is another one of our podcasts. We talked about Robert Wise as the editor there. He was nominated for an Oscar for the editing on Citizen Kane, which was very excellent. He would then go on to directing B films for a time before graduating to A-list.
I was going to say, he is fascinating. IMDb. Go to the bottom of it and you see everything before West Side Story and The Sound of
Music. Yeah,
it's a lot of schlock.
Yeah, B movies.
Yeah.
But an interesting thing about him was he was an avid fan of Indian cinema. Like, I assume they mean India.
Like Bollywood.
Yes, that's what I think they mean. His favorite film was The Ten Commandments. And besides being known for West Side Story and The Sound of Music, he also directed Star Trek, the motion picture, as a favor to his wife, who was a huge Star Trek
his
fan.
His post-Sound of Music career is also just as interesting.
Yeah.
And also, The Ten Commandments thing makes sense. You can definitely see some of that epic scale
in
The Sound of Music. I think he was like, I gotta get some of this out of my system.
Yeah. And he lived to be 91, which is going to be a theme here with some of our people. Now, I know you were saying some of the people you didn't think deserved the Academy Award nominations. The one who I think did was our cinematographer, Ted McCord.
My God, did he.
But I'm not sure why he... I don't know who was he was up against, why he... But he, I thought he could have easily won that.
That movie is a marvel of it direction is. And cinematography.
Yes.
It was interesting to me, and again, I'm not taking away from anyone here, but... It was interesting to me that the editor got a nomination for this one because, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with the editing and the Sound of Music. I just don't think that's what stood out to me as much rewatching it for the umpteenth time. Mm-hmm. I was like, my God, Robert Weiss knows where to put his camera and the cinematographer knows how to make this landscape and Julie Andrews look incredible. The editing, there are many musicals that owe a lot to their editing. Yeah. I don't know that this is the one I would have chosen to nominate for an Oscar.
Well, he won the editor.
I know. That's I don't know what he was up against, and I'm happy for him.
Yeah.
I just don't know that I would have put him there in the first place based on this, but who knows what kind of movie that
it doesn't
was.
Surprise me that an editor won an Oscar on a film that a previous editor was the director of, because generally, in my experiences, directors that you started out as editors tend to go through the process with their editors. And there's a lot of things that I think in editing people might attribute to the cinematographer incorrectly. I thought the editing was really good. I was really impressed with it. But I'll talk about that as we go through the film. But
and
I
again, there's nothing wrong with the editing and the Sound of Music, to be clear. I just think it's more of a director's and cinematographer achievement. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. So some interesting things about this film as far as the cinematography. So The Sound of Music was shot in 70mm Todd AO. Have you ever heard of Todd AO?
Not before looking it up today.
Todd AO began as a high resolution widescreen format. It was developed in the early 1950s by Mike Todd, who was one of Elizabeth Taylor's husbands. Mike Todd, a Broadway producer and United Artists Theaters, in partnership with the American Optical Company in Buffalo, New York. It was developed to provide a high-definition, single-camera, widescreen process to compete with Cinerama, or as characterized by its creator, Cinerama out of one hole.
Sure. I have no comment on that.
Where Cinerama used a complicated setup of three separate strips of film photographed simultaneously, Todd AO required only a single camera and lens.
Sounds like the IMAX of its day.
Yeah.
Almost.
I mean, it was sort of the beginning of 70mm widescreen cameras. After that, you go to like Panavision. That's what Lawrence of Arabia was shot in. That's kind of an offshoot of Todd AO.
It paid off. That's for sure. Using
beautiful.
That for this movie.
Then this film was produced with deluxe color processing. Deluxe Color is a Deluxe Laboratories brand of color processing for motion pictures. It is a Eastman-based color. They created this to sort of get away from Technicolor, because Technicolor was a little bit of a monopoly at the time, mass-producing all the prints. Eastman Color had a single-strip color process, which would replace the three-strip Technicolor. We talked about this slightly in The Journey, because they had Metrocolor on that. So each of the studios kind of had their own laboratory at that point, and 20th Century was Deluxe Color.
All I can say is that at least the Disney Plus version of it looks modern.
Like, it's beautiful.
If you didn't know this movie was from the 60s, you would be like, somebody did a really, really good job of recreating the look of 60s movies. It's
very beautiful.
It's incredible. Like, what, 50 plus years later?
They did a Blu-ray restoration on it.
That's so, probably the version that you see on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I think so.
Which makes sense.
Ted McCord was nominated. This is a cinematographer still. He was nominated for 3 Academy Awards. This film, 2 for The Seesaw. And Johnny Belinda. He worked his way up from cameraman assistant to cinematographer, starting out in 1917 and working his way through the silent era. One of his early mentors was Greg Tolan, who was the great cinematographer from Citizen Kane. Amazing cinematographer.
Wouldn't have guessed this movie has as much Citizen Kane DNA as it has.
Yeah, and I see some similarities. But during the 50s and 60s, McCord excelled at other Technicolor assignments. Most memorable are rich saturation and sharp detail used for the gripping outdoor western The Hanging Tree, and his Oscar-nominated romantic soft-focus visuals for The Sound of Music. He is also known for Treasure of the Sierra Madre and East of Eden, which is a James Dean film.
Again, the pedigree of the people on this movie. Everyone...
Yeah, this is an A-list crew.
Everyone should have seen this coming.
Yeah, this is a 100% A-list crew. Your crew is great here. Your editor, William Reynolds, he is a 7-time Oscar nominee.
A very, very talented man.
He won Best Editing Academy Award for this film and also for The Sting.
Oh, wow.
this thing, yeah.
No, I didn't know he did that one.
Yeah,
nice.
And he started out at 20th Century Fox as a prop boy before moving to assistant editor and then full editor. He would become 20th Century Fox's premier editor and favorite of former editor Robert Weiss. He did a lot of Robert Weiss movies. He is known for The Godfather and Hello, Dolly. See, now don't you feel bad?
Yes, I feel bad. The editing on this movie is fine. It just isn't the most important thing. I'm surprised I got nominated for an Academy Award. That's all. He's a great guy. He clearly has more than enough accolades.
The score by Irwin Costell. Now, here's my one that I have an issue with, this score guy.
I want to hear your hot take.
Okay, so he's a 5-time Oscar nominee. Won 2 Oscars for Best Score, this film and West Side Story. Irwin is an interesting guy. He was self-taught at symphonic arranging and composing. He taught himself how to do that. He learned by studying symphonic scores at his local library. He never went to school.
Invest in libraries.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Libraries are good places. He would begin his career on television and then move to orchestrating plays and musicals on Broadway, including The Music Man. He's also known for Mary Poppins, Bedknobs, and Broomsticks. But all the songs in this film are from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway play, were created by Rodgers and Hammerstein, but they were orchestrated and conducted by Irwin. He also adapted the instrumental underscore passages, which to me means he basically took the songs and put them as score music as well. So why do you get an Oscar for that?
Well, I mean, adapting that stuff from the stage to the film is an acquired talent. It's not something that people who don't have a good appreciation and understanding of how Broadway works could do, I imagine.
But my point is that he didn't create any music for this.
Did he place it in the right spots?
He orchestrated the music, yes. He orchestrated and conducted.
Well, when you're talking about The Sound of Music, I think people are just like, let's just give it every sound award we can.
Yeah. Well, so, why don't we give the award to Rodgers and Hammerstein since their songs and
their
music?
You make an excellent case. And I'm sure people at the time are trying to make that case,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, that was my only like little quabble about
that's
that.
That's less egregious than me talking about the editor of The Godfather.
Yeah, I was just doing that to get back at you.
I deserve that.
But 2 new songs were created for this film that were not in the Broadway play. The song Something Good and I Have Confidence, which were written by Richard Rodgers by himself.
One for two.
Yeah, Richard Rodgers, because at that point when he wrote the songs, Oscar Hammerstein had died in 1960. And the final song Oscar Hammerstein wrote was Edelweiss.
Wow. Wow.
What a great ending one.
I don't think we have to talk about those two. I think their work speaks for itself.
Oh, yeah. I love the music. I love the songs in this film. I'm sorry. I guess I have some corniness to me, but I adore the music.
When we were trying to workshop a musical to do, this is the one we settled on for a reason. It's one, again, I wasn't going to make you talk about a movie that was mediocre this time. This is an unassailable classic.
Which was the new ones did you not like? Something Good?
I mean, we can get into this more later, but I maintain that the last hour of this movie is a little slow.
I know, you don't need to like it. The Something Good is one of my least favorite of the songs,
okay,
to
good.
Be honest.
We can be candid here. Great.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a little bit of trivia before we get into the plot. The real Maria Von Trapp has a brief uncredited cameo as a passerby alongside her daughter, Rosemary, and the daughter of Warner Von Trapp. It's during the song I Have Confidence. As Julie Andrews is going through the town, she's one of the passerbyers. I guess you have to look carefully for her. This film was shot in Salzburg and also on 20th Century Studios. Most of the interiors were shot in the studio, especially the shots at the villa. The film was shot in 5 months, which surprises me. This is a 3-hour film.
5 months is still a really long time to make anything.
I feel like that's short.
Just knowing how long it takes certain things that film in Pittsburgh to make.
I feel like that's very short to make a film like this, 5 months. I would have thought it would take much longer. Christopher Plummer was dubbed by Bill Lee, who dubbed voices in Disney and other musicals. The Mother Superior, played by Peggy Wood, was dubbed on Climb Every Mountain by...
That's my other Oscar hot take.
Oh. She was dubbed on Climb Every Mountain by Marjorie MacKay. And Marnie Nixon, who famously dubbed many lead actresses in musicals, had an actual role in this film. She played Sister Sophia. She actually got to be an actress.
Oh, good for Marnie.
I know. I thought that was nice. The Sound of Music, not surprisingly, one of the most commercially successful films of all time. 4 weeks after its theatrical release, it became the number one box office movie in the United States. It held the number one position for 30 of the next 43 weeks and ended up the highest grossing film of 1965. The Sound of Music broke previous box office records in 29 countries, and by November 1966, The Sound of Music had become the highest grossing film of all time, with over $67.5 million in worldwide rentals, surpassing Gone with the Wind that had held that distinction for 24 years. Let's talk about The Sound of Music.
Can I give one little piece of trivia to you real quick?
Go ahead.
The first time I watched The Sound of Music was actually in Salzburg, Austria.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It was during my college days, about a decade ago now, which is a wild thing to say. I was studying abroad there, and we were staying at Schloss Leopoldsgrund, which I believe some of the Sound of Music was filmed there.
It is.
That's where the gazebo was.
Yeah.
Yeah, they made us watch it for obvious reasons, and it was a blast. And then a bunch of us took the Sound of Music tour, and we got to see a bunch of other locations, like the church. And yeah, so this movie is, it's a great movie, but also it reminds me of some of the most formative 3 weeks of my life.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, yeah, that is really cool. I would love to go and see those sites for the sign.
Salzburg lives up. Let me tell you. Those hills are alive. I can't even deny it.
Walking up and down them must not be very fun.
You just have to go to that field once to get your Maria picture and call it a day.
Yeah, well, let's start out there because the first thing you're going to see, well, actually, it starts out very interestingly to me because the first thing you kind of see is clouds and overhead shots of the mountains, and they're clearly filming in a helicopter. It's obvious that they are, but it's really beautifully done, especially when they go through the clouds. It looks really pretty, and I really love this one shot where they transition, this is probably your editor, where they transition from the clouds right onto the snow in the mountain very seamlessly. It almost looks like it just becomes clouds to snow. It's really beautifully done. I noticed in the beginning there's a bird sound, just the sound of a bird at first when they're flying.
Oh, we're talking about birds again.
Yeah, the birds, yeah. And then you get these beautiful shots of the lake and the mountains. It's a really spectacular opening. And then the music itself comes on, and okay, so maybe he did do a little bit of his own creating of the score, because there's a kind of a bird-like, you hear the birds and then it turns into a bird-like piece of music, which then eventually is going to turn into the Sound of Music.
I think the brilliance of most of the first 15, 20 minutes of this movie is that Robert Weiss was like, I'm pretty much just going to train my camera at the beauty of Austria or Julie Andrews and just let them cook.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, fine, there's some editing tricks in there that I probably wasn't giving them enough credit for. But honestly, the landscape and her, they do enough on their own.
Yeah.
Like, that's why, again, I think this movie is a marvel of direction and cinematography, but okay, fine, Godfather editor, you were right. I might have to eat crow on that
I one. Don't know that Robert Weiss was manning the camera, but we'll give him the credit.
Well, that's the cinematographer.
We'll give him the credit.
That could be the cinematographer.
Yeah, that's definitely the cinematographer. So then it comes up to the scene where you're eventually zooming in and zooming down and zooming down, and there's Julie Andrews. And they said that it was quite funny because when they were trying to shoot this on the helicopter, the wind from the helicopter kept knocking her down, and she couldn't even stand up to try to do the scene because every time she tried to stand up, the helicopter draft would knock her down. And I think that's why that is such a quick part where she's standing, and then all of a sudden it goes right to a close-up to her, which would have been the editor.
Yeah, okay. This is gonna be a thing now.
So yes, what I really love about this film specifically, and this is what I think is great about the editing, is that they go, the way they change many shots from far away to close-up to side angle to front angle to back angle, they do a beautiful job in many of the scenes. They do this throughout the entire film. It's really nicely done. And then you get your church bells, and then you get your intro music montage, and then they have those different scenic photographs. They're just still photographs that they have the credits going over.
There are a lot of movies where I feel like that's a lazy way to get people into the story, but when you are
like
in
it.
Salzburg
yeah.
and you are just taking photos of Salzburg and the surrounding mountains, yeah, man, no notes.
Yeah, I like that that's what they did the credits over. And that way, the credits aren't blocking over somebody doing something. You're not trying to watch action while you're...
It's also always a little jarring to me that I remember that movies used to have their credits before they really start. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to watch this montage of of people's names over this beautiful landscape. Yeah. I'm not mad at this.
Yeah. And then what else is really interesting is at the end of the credits, they have this golden tint. Did you see that golden tint over the picture? And it says Salzburg, Austria in the last golden days of the 30s. And they actually put a golden tint on the film, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, that gold comes back too. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then we're starting out the Abbey. You hear a lot of these church choir-like songs in the background, the nuns singing, which I think is a really pretty background for the Abbey. They can't find Maria. They're arguing about Maria and how troublesome she is and so forth. And then they go into the song, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria?
Anger. Absolute
yeah.
banger.
Yeah, yeah. The song is beautifully done because the nuns harmonize really pretty in the song. There's a lot of really beautiful harmony in a lot of these songs. I really appreciate it.
This is also our first indication that this is going to be a really funny movie because that yeah. song is actually hilarious. If,
yes.
if you listen to how they're describing Maria and how accurately they're describing her too as things turn out. Like, how do you hold a cloud in your hand? That's just good writing. So that's your Oscar
don't
and Hammerstein writing.
Don't they use the word flippery jippered or something like that?
They use a very 60s word to describe her that I'm sure was accurate at the time. Who knows?
And then the mother abbess, that's Peggy Wood. She's talking to Maria. She's telling her she has to leave the abbey because it just doesn't seem to be Maria's thing. And she wants to send her to be a governess to a local family with 7 children. I think a lot of people are very familiar about the plot. I want to point out when we do this podcast is a lot of people know The Sound of Music. What I want to point out is things that people might not see in The Sound of Music that make it even more special than I think people are aware of, like the camera work, the cinematography, the editing, stuff like that. Because when Maria's leaving the Abbey, there's a beautiful pan down from the top of the building when she leaves the Abbey to her, and you can hear this faint choir church singing, and then it goes into the I Have Confidence song.
Now, I will say, prior to my editing hot take, Confidence is the one song that I was like, this is the editor yeah. did this, because it goes to multiple locations.
Yep.
It's honestly, Confidence is sort of two songs in one anyway, because yeah. it starts off one way and then ends with her singing and clapping her feet together. But also the end of that, when she's gallivanting towards the gates to the manor,
yeah.
that's really just Robert Weiss or the cinematographer, whoever's behind the camera.
Behind the camera is always going to be the cinematographer.
Moving back yeah. and just letting her do her thing.
That's what I thought was interesting. The camera movement to me was interesting in many of the sequences. I couldn't quite tell. As a matter of fact, like, it's when she's going down the square, I almost feel like, was it on the back of a vehicle? I thought it was moving like it was on the back of a vehicle.
It was definitely moving in time with her, that's yeah. for sure. It's oddly minimalist for a big, large-scale movie musical like this. These days, I guess I think of frenetic editing a lot when it comes to this. So I guess maybe that's where my take on the editing came from. Some of it is actually pretty restrained, which is also a skill in and of itself.
It's very restrained. And yeah. there's one of the things he did with the editing is he didn't put a lot of dissolves or anything like that on. It's pretty much seamless from one angle to the next angle. It's all done very seamlessly without dissolves. There's very few dissolves that I noticed.
Same. Yeah, the only one I can remember is honestly the intermission one.
Yeah, that's the only fade to black I even saw, yeah. So anyhow, I thought that big horse fountain in the square was really interesting. And then I really loved when she's riding on the bus and you can see the reflection of the lake and the scenery in the window. I thought that was excellent, excellent camera work. And then she trips when she gets off the bus, and it said that was not even in the script. She did that by accident, and Robert Weiss like, yep, leave it in.
I feel like the word adorkable was invented yes. maybe 40 years later, but I'm not sure anybody exudes that energy more than 1960s Julie Andrews.
Yeah, he said that he liked it because it made her seem very awkward, and that's what he wanted to portray. I'm really impressed with the camera work. I'm really impressed with the camera movement. I'd love to know how they did that, whether they had a trolley, because it seemed like they had something more smooth than a trolley. And the way, I don't know, they did a lot of really cool movement in the camera. And then the funny thing when she comes up to the door and she thinks the butler is Captain Von Trapp. And they said that in real life that happened to the real Maria Von Trapp. So that's why they put it in.
That's good, because I know that there's definitely some disputes about the accuracy of this telling
yeah.
of the Von Trapp
oh,
story.
Yeah, no,
so.
this is not verbatim actress. This is not
no.
verbatim to the story. But that part was something that she actually did. She thought the butler was Captain Von Trapp. However you say his name, Georg. Georg.
I'm not even going to try.
Well, that's what the Baroness calls him all the time, Georg.
It's one of those movies where everyone has either a German or an Austrian
yeah.
name, but everyone has a British accent. You just have to go with it. It's fine.
It's spelled like George, but it's pronounced Georg, I guess. But anyhow, so then this is another thing they do. When she gets into the house, you get these close-up shot of her, and then you get the faraway shot. Like, they do that a lot, the very close up, the very far away. It's really beautiful. And I noticed when she came in, you don't hear any music in the house. And I thought that was symbolic for the fact that he outlawed music. Like, especially when she's in the ballroom and he catches her in the ballroom, there's just no sound other than their voices. And I love the shot of him in the doorway. I thought that was an excellent shot. He's in a shadow. It makes him look very foreboding.
The lighting in this movie is fascinating. Oh, we should talk really about nice. It at some point.
Yeah, it's beautiful. This is beautifully shot. This is a beautifully done. The cinematographer did a fantastic job on this film.
See, we agree on that.
Ted McCord. Yeah, I'm not familiar with him, but wow, what a fantastic job. I'm really impressed. I like when she says, well, you don't look at all like a SEAL captain, sir. And he says, well, you don't look like a governess.
The writing is also like...
it's funny, very funny.
I don't know how much is transposed from the original musical, yeah. But I mean...
Well, Ernest Lehman, he was a very well-known screenwriter.
Yeah, whether it was the original book writer or him, there's some bars.
Yeah, it's very funny. Was he even nominated? I don't think he was nominated.
Which again, I think people think of The Sound of Music and they think of almost everything before the writing, but yeah. The actual like
the writing
dialogue
is
pretty
yeah.
good.
Like you said, it's quite funny. There's many very funny, especially the captain has a lot of good dry quips.
Chris Plummer, man.
Yeah. Let's actually talk about Julie Andrews real quick since we've introduced her character. She is a 3-time Oscar nominee. She won Best Actress for Mary Poppins. Her parents divorced when she was young, although her father was not actually her biological father. Apparently her mother had some sort of affair on the father and that was a result.
Scandalous.
Yeah, a little scandalous. Her mother remarried after the non-biological father divorced, and her stepfather was a stage actor. Her mother became a stage actor, but supposedly her stepfather was an alcoholic and violent, and she had to lock her door to prevent him from getting into bed with her. She was a child.
Woof.
Gross, yeah. Her parents discovered her singing ability and sent her for professional voice lessons. She would begin singing in shows with her parents. Her solo career would begin at age 12, and she would alternate between stage and television. At 19, she made her debut on Broadway in The Boyfriend. That would get her an audition for My Fair Lady, the Broadway version, which made her a Broadway star, as you know, and would get her noticed by the film industry, but not noticed enough to put her in My Fair Lady, as we know. She possessed a 5-octave soprano range until a vocal nodule surgery mishap ruined her singing voice. Terrible.
Nodes. They get a lot of people.
Yes, it's terrible. She learned to play the guitar specifically for this role, as did Christopher Plummer, although they would dub Christopher Plummer's guitar playing. She was married to Blake Edwards. I think a lot of people know that. And she is still alive.
She is an international treasure.
She is. She's wonderful.
I mean, it was interesting to me reading some of the casting what-ifs for this, and who knows how true this is, but I believe this movie was originally conceived with Audrey Hepburn in mind as
yes.
Maria, and yeah. then I also think once that was no longer the case, I believe Grace Kelly and
yep,
Pittsburgh's own Shirley Jones were considered.
You can see why they would, well, not Grace Kelly so much, but you could see why Shirley Jones and Audrey Hepburn, they have that sort of ingenue, sweet way about them.
And they
as
can
well.
Be funny, so that makes yeah. sense. But yeah. No, Julie Andrews. And
she's perfect
And it seems like they saw her, and I think Robert and Ernest on early cut of Mary Poppins, and were like, we need to snatch her up before
yes,
she becomes
they did say that.
Like a,
yes.
a superstar, and they were right.
Yeah.
They bet on her, and she... made them smart.
Yeah, that was a great casting choice. She's perfect. And then it's funny because he talks to her. He's very sarcastic about her clothing. She said, we had to give everything to the poor, but they didn't want this outfit. And he was like, I'm not surprised. Something along those
lines.
He's
very droll.
He's very dry wit. And he talks about how the governess keep leaving, and he has this discipline. He's got this whistle that he whistles for the kids with and so forth. And the kids all come in. And Brigitta, she comes in reading a book. She's not marching in line like the rest of the kids, but then they all have to do their little march in line and introduce themselves. And then he wants to whistle for Maria, and she's like, no, we don't whistle for me. And then the fuck is so funny when she says, what's your signal, sir? What should I call you on the whistle?
I will say, last night when I was watching this movie, I was doing it through headphones on my laptop, and the whistling, my wife was like, what on earth are you watching right now? Because it was loud enough, I guess, that she was just hearing
loud.
That sound over and over again through headphones.
Yeah.
That's good sound design. It
yeah.
is jarring.
It's
and
loud.
Is an unpleasant noise. And what he's doing to those kids is unpleasant.
Yeah,
so
correct.
I get it.
And we see, obviously, you get the impression you get from the captain right off the bat as that he's kind of arrogant, doesn't seem to have a very warm feeling towards his children. He's very disciplinary and very, I guess, he's supposed to be a Navy captain. He very much acts like he's in the military. So that's sort of the impression you get of him right off the bat. which I think some of the way Christopher Plummer was in that part of the film is some of the way Christopher Plummer was in real life. I get that impression that Christopher Plummer was kind of an arrogant guy and not the nicest of fellows.
Yeah, he looked the way he did in the 60s. I think there are a lot of men who were allowed to act that way because of that.
Oh, yeah. If you're not good looking, you can be a jerk.
I'm just saying that just seems to be what happened.
Yeah. Maria tries to be friendly with the kids. She wants to know their names again without the whistle, and they tell her a little bit about themselves. But then as she's walking up the stairs, what does she find in her pocket? A frog, and she freaks out. Although, personally, I don't think I'd freak out, but, you know, I guess some people don't like frogs.
They're slimy, and I wouldn't want one in my pocket.
It'd be shocking, yeah, a little shocking to find one in your pocket. But the housekeeper tells her she was lucky because the last governess got a snake.
I forgot how mischievous the kids were.
Yeah.
I don't know why. For some reason, I didn't remember that part. I remembered them bonding pretty quickly, but yeah. I didn't remember that
trick her.
Yeah, they were originally like, we're going to get rid of all of our governesses in days.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the next trick they play is she comes in for dinner and she sits down and she screams and she stands up right away, and you see there's a pine cone on her seat.
Which later is the moment that Captain Von Trapp will say is when he first fell in love with her.
Yeah, I think it's funny because he says, did you learn to do that at the Abbey? It's just so funny. And they're about to do the dinner and she says, oh, can we have a prayer? And he begrudgingly lets her have the prayer, and then she starts guilting the children and saying all these things, and they start crying, and the captain's like, are we going to go through this at every meal, or is this just for dinner?
The kids are great. I don't think we will continue to say this, but it should be mentioned. There's not a weak link amongst the kids.
No, we can talk about the kids.
I will be perfectly honest. I don't remember all of the actors' names.
That's okay.
Hands.
I got them all for us.
That's why you're the podcaster.
I'm going to go through very quickly the kids. Okay, but this girl's name is a little hard. So Charmian Carr. She plays.
I'm going to trust you.
She plays Liesel. That's the oldest girl.
You guys can't see this, but she has reams of notes on this.
I think I have like 35
Wendy is so
pages.
Prepared. It's insane.
This Charmian Carr, her mother was a vaudeville actress, her father a musician. As a college student, she would do some modeling to bring in extra cash. A friend of hers, who was also a model, found out that Robert Weiss was looking for a girl to play Liesel, and the friend sent Charmian, or however you say her name's, picture to him without her knowing. And she was shocked when he called her up for a tryout. She had never acted or sang previously, but she still won the role. She did not appear in any more films after this. She would go on to have an interior decorating business, and one of her clients was Michael Jackson.
I don't know what to do with any of that, but Liesel is the MVP of the kids, so yeah, more power to her.
Her younger sister, Darlene, dubbed some of her singing as well as some of the other children's singing.
Huh.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Then you go to the next one. It would be Nicholas Hammond. He plays Friedrich. That's the boy, the second one in line, I think. He was the first actor to play Spider-Man in a live-action production. And he was in the Quentin Tarantino movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Of course, he is still alive. The next girl down, Heather Menzies, she played Louisa. She's the blonde girl. She's from Canada. This was her film debut. She wound up doing a lot of other films. She played a lot of ingenue roles. She got sick of that, so she decided to pose nude in Playboy so they could see her in a different light.
Gotta make a living somehow.
Yeah, and after that, she got a lot more grown up, less ingenue roles. And then Dwayne Chase, he played Kurt. That's the other boy. He started acting at age 11. He is now a software engineer for an oil and mining company, and he is a mountain climber. Ironic.
Of course.
He is also still alive. I don't think Heather Menzies is alive. Heather Menzies and Charmian Carr are the only two that are not alive, I believe. Angela Cartwright, will be interesting to you. She plays Brigitta. That's the little girl with the black hair with the book. She is the sister of Veronica Cartwright, which is funny because we talked about Veronica Cartwright in our other show, The Birds.
I honestly didn't even know that when
I didn't know that either until I read that.
When I suggested this.
She was known for the TV series Lost in Space. She is an artist and a photographer, and she is still alive. Marta, that's second to the youngest girl, was Debbie Turner. She became a skilled skier, even a champion ski racer. There's a lot of mountain...
I'd like to believe she started that during her time in Salzburg.
Yeah, there's a lot of these mountain references here with the children. She has an upscale floral design business. She is also still alive. And the little one, Gretel Kim Carrath. She started acting at age 3 in Spencer's Mountain, which is a Henry Fonda movie. And she would work a lot in TV, including All My Children.
Just an elite young child acting performance.
Oh, yeah.
Just her batting average is so high.
And she's so cute. And they did say the little girl, Marta, throughout the entire filming process, she kept losing teeth and they had to keep replacing false teeth to cover up the one she had
Again,
lost.
Again, to a person, this is some of the best child acting you'll ever see in a movie.
Their kids are all great. Anyhow, back to the plot.
Back to this very long movie.
This is going to be a long podcast, but we're going to get through it as quickly as we can. So anyhow, then Rolf shows up on his bike.
The worst.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Rolf.
If anyone came up to me and was like, my favorite character in The Sound of Music was Rolf, I would turn the other way.
Would you?
Yeah.
You'd be like, I can't speak to you.
I honestly think that's a deal breaker.
It is a deal breaker. Okay, I think this is an easy thing to miss in the film. Because when he first comes up to the door, there's a weird exchange between him and the butler. And you sense this political undercurrent.
It's really the first indication. It's like, oh, right, this is pre-World War II.
Yeah, it's sort of a clue, too, to later on in the film. But it's something you can miss very easily if you're not looking for it. So he's delivering this telegram for the cap. He gets it. He says he's going to Vienna. And then the children start asking about the Baroness. And we realize then that there's some romantic involvement with this person. And Liesel wants to know who delivered the telegram. And then she sort of sneaks out when they're all talking about the Baroness. She sort of sneaks out of the room.
I don't know if you know, but she's 16 going on 17. Yeah. That's just what 16-year-olds do.
Well, true. I mean, she runs out to the gazebo to meet Rolf. There's two gazebo scenes, and they both have this very misty, romantic look. This is your soft focus, I think. Rolf is talking about the Germans potentially taking over Austria already. Rolf is not a swell.
Certainly espousing some white supremacist ideas.
Yeah, I see. He's not a swell guy. And then it intros into the 16 going on 17. Now, they said that when they were dancing, this scene is really beautiful. Dancing is really nicely choreographed. I really enjoy the dancing in this particular
song. Especially when she's on top of the little benches and he keeps leading her around
doing
in a
these
circle.
Leaps.
It gets faster and more graceful as she goes.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. But unfortunately, what happened was at one point she slipped and her foot went through the glass in the gazebo.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and she hurt her ankle and she had to continue on with her ankle all bandaged up, said she was in a lot of pain.
What a trooper.
She kept on. After that happens, there's a scene with the housekeeper, Maria. She's kind of telling her the backstory of the captain, how he had lost his wife. He was a different man. Now he doesn't want music in the house, blah, 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 blah.
I gotta say, I would love to know
the first wife.
I just need to know what he was like with that first wife, because he does a really, really quick 180.
Yeah.
And it has to be somewhere, I don't know. I think it has to be somewhere between Footloose guy and I'm the happiest man on earth. I would just love to know where he was pre-Maria and pre his first wife.
This is literally the only reference, I think, on almost the entire film to the first wife. She is not really mentioned whatsoever.
This is the only characterization question I really have.
But I guess this is where you learn the backstory about the wife. This is the point of the scene. Maria wants material for the kids' play clothes, and then the housekeeper does sort of mention this Baroness, and the captain's probably going to marry her. And at this point, Liesel is trying to sneak through the window while Maria was saying her prayers. She helps her. She doesn't rat her out.
She's a cool mom.
Yeah, she kind of bonds with her. And then there's a thunderstorm. The little Gretel comes into the room. And then all the other girls come into the room. And they say, oh, the boys won't come in. They're not scared. And then another thunder and the boys come in. And she lets them all in the bed.
Great sound design. Just immaculate timing.
The thunder.
And yeah.
It's a nice scene where she's first bonding with the children. And it goes into the song, "These Are a Few of My Favorite Things." But then, of course, everybody's all delightful and happy. And here comes the captain to make everybody miserable.
Almost literally a record scratch when the captain comes into the room. it's really funny.
And the music just boom. And then everybody immediately is in their discipline thing. And he starts questioning Liesel, and Maria covers for her. He tells her he wants discipline. She can't have play clothes. And then at the end of the scene, she's just eyeing the curtains a la Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind.
Just a few of her favorite things.
The next thing you see is that the kids are going on all these outings around town. It's a montage with My Favorite Things. This is another place where the editor, they had to do all these beautiful camera work. The editor sort of seamlessly put the shots together, and they're wearing now the curtains.
It did take less than 24 hours for the kids to also do a 180 on Maria,
which
I think one could argue is a little fast, but I do think that's just the power of
Julie Andrews.
Of Julie Andrews plus a dork ability.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're wearing these play clothes made of the curtains, clearly. And these montages are really nice. Like I said, they have a lot of beautiful camera shots of the scenic areas.
Really quickly, I forget that the costume designer got an Oscar nomination.
Yes.
Good, because
yes.
The costumes in this movie, again, just those drape clothes being like a good example of them. They're really, really
spectacular. And we didn't mention the costume designer, so my apologies, but we only had so much time, so we couldn't just list everybody.
Way to go.
But again, I love the montages of them running around the streets, cutting to different clothes, different days. I don't know if they do the different clothes on this one. They do that, I think, on the Do Re Mi song. But then you wind up there having a picnic on a hill with the mountain behind. This is an interesting point. The kids admit they pick on the governesses to get their father's attention. I thought that was a really important statement.
I felt bad during this scene because my brain has been so 21st century movie pilled that for a second I was like, is that a green screen or are they actually on that hill? And then I remembered this is the 60s and I was like, they are definitely actually on that hill.
You know what? I thought that too because there's certain points in this film where the mountains look like they are matted in, honestly. They really do.
They really are that beautiful. I have seen them, but in all seriousness, I'm now angry again at 21st century movies for making my brain do that.
But anyhow, the kids, she wants them to sing. They say they don't know how to sing and that their father doesn't like them to sing. And she teaches them the Do Re Mi song, which is, it's such a cute song, really.
Which again, by the way, just a spectacular example of just keep the camera in one or a few places and just let them all run around and have fun.
Yeah. Well, actually, the beginning, when she's first singing, teaching it to them at the picnic, they're all sort of sitting on the hill around Maria. And this is when you see they do such a really beautiful job with the camera and the editing is they'll have a close up of Maria playing the guitar. They'll pull back and they'll have the whole scene and it'll be from the front. It'll be from the back. It'll be from the side. And they just keep switching the angles and the close up from.
This is a very nerdy thing to say, but the coverage of this movie is pretty incredible. Like they always say when you're making a movie, cover every scene from every possible angle.
Yep.
Because you never know what you want to use. And my God, did they use all of them, especially in a sequence like this.
And that's actually really great editing and really great camera work because
I officially take my take back. The editing's elite. He deserves his Oscar.
Because the reason why is that you get bored looking at the same thing after a while. So when you're in a scene where you're going to be doing the same thing for a while, if you change all the angles and so forth, that keeps people's interest.
Yeah, Wendy wore me down. I was wrong.
Sorry. Maybe you can make me feel differently about the score.
We'll see.
So anyhow, I was really impressed by that. I would never have noticed that if I wasn't really looking for it.
But then you also get that top-down shot of them all dancing around the fountain's edge.
Yes.
And that's all cinematography right there.
Yeah. So then this is when they go on the whole montage with the Do Re Mi and they're in different outfits. They're again, the camera's moving along with them as they're walking. It's so interesting how they did that, whether they had that on a dolly or I'm just really curious. It surely couldn't have been handheld. There wasn't some person running around
with
the camera.
No, it would be choppier, I think, if
it was
handheld.
It was very smooth. That's why I was like, is this a doll? How could they have done it on a dolly, though?
It must have been either perfectly timed if it was like a car or
I felt like it was on the back of some sort of a vehicle, even if it wasn't a car per se. If it was, I don't know.
See, that's where Robert Weiss comes in. Like, that's all directing, figuring out how to physically do those sort of things. So.
Yeah. You know what? Robert Weiss does do a commentary on this, and I didn't have the time to listen to it. I wanted to.
It is a 3-hour movie.
But I wondered if he would have explained some of the camera tricks. I would be curious to go back. And anybody who wants to know, maybe listen to the Robert Weiss. I would highly recommend it. The bicycling scene. Again, how are they're bicycling. How is the camera moving so fast away from them?
Robert Weiss probably has the answers and has given them somewhere.
It's so interesting.
Again, he certainly deserved his Oscar.
Yeah, I think the cinematographer deserved an Oscar, but he didn't get it.
Yeah, that might be the most egregious the nominees who didn't win.
Yeah, I'd be very curious if I knew that year who had won the first cinematography. It would be very interesting to know. I wrote, nice overhead shot by the fountain. Same thing.
Look, this is why we get along.
Yeah, I had that in my notes. But the one thing I don't like, when the captain and the baroness are coming along in the car, there's the rear projection and I knew it.
The second I saw that, I was like, oh man, this is going to be her least favorite part of the movie.
You know how I feel about rear projection. Both from the back and the side rear projection. I'm like...
By that point in the 60s, that was unnecessary. They didn't need that.
I know we were fussing about that in The Birds, but this is when the kids are hanging in the trees and the captain. He almost does like a double take, like, wait a second.
Local urchins, or whatever he calls them.
Yes, he calls them local urchins. Then he's like, wait, what? Were those my kids? And then the Baroness and the captain arrive at the villa. it's quite clear that the Baroness is trying to catch the captain. That's what I would say. She's trying to make him define the relationship. She's being very aggressive. And the scenery in that villa, that outdoor back villa shot, is just absolutely gorgeous.
As good as it gets.
It's amazing. And
yeah, you can just point your camera at Salzburg, and the castles.
It's beautiful.
It's really hard to screw that up.
Yeah, but wherever they shot that, I think that was at that place you were talking about.
I'm going to kick myself for this because, again, I was there. I'm pretty sure that lake is the castle where we stayed. Yeah.
I think so. I think that's what I read.
I took many walks around that lake for obvious reasons.
It is just absolutely beautiful. And they showed that back of the villa scene a lot, and with good reason. But I think the captain seems uncomfortable to commit when she's doing all this sort of aggressive talk.
He's doing a lot of aggressive talk, too. Wasn't he like, you save me, basically?
Yeah, he did say that. But then when it comes to more stuff, he seems to back off a little bit.
Yeah.
So then we also have Max here as well, Max. So anyhow, we're missing talking about some of these actors.
We should talk
about Eleanor Parker. Eleanor Parker plays the Baroness. She's a longtime film actress. She's a very popular movie star. As a matter of fact, she was brought on because she was the only one that had any movie star cred in this entire cast, basically.
That's wild, by the way, that after... After Mary Poppins, Julie Andrews still wasn't the biggest star in the world immediately.
I believe that Mary Poppins hadn't come out when they did this.
Oh, that's true. Again, they poached her after seeing the rough cut of Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
At this point,
when they were filming this, Julie Andrews was not well known. But so Eleanor Parker was the only person that had any movie star cred, so that's why they wanted her. But she was nominated for 3 Oscars. She didn't win. She was from Ohio. She grew up around Cleveland.
Okay. We forgive her.
I know. We forgive her. As a child, she wanted to be an actress, and she would participate in school plays. After school, she would move to California to be part of the Pasadena Playhouse in the hopes of becoming a film actress. And guess what? She was spotted in the audience, not even on the stage, just sitting in the audience by a Warner Brothers talent scout. He offered her a screen test. She went and did that. They immediately signed her to a long-term contract. This is the stuff of dreams. It's so easy for her.
When it's meant to be, it's meant to be.
Yeah, and she would have success later on in her career when she signed with MGM in the early 1950s. She's known for Of Human Bondage, the second one, the remake. Chain Lightning and Caged. She also lived to be 91 years old. And from what I understand about Eleanor Parker, not to be a gossip, she was quite the amorous girl on set. She was always having affairs with her co-stars. As a matter of fact, Christopher Plummer said she was involved with the cameraman in this particular...
I thought you were about to say with Christopher Plummer, and I was...
No, but there, was Christopher Plummer, there was a lot of crushes going on in this
particular
film.
Yeah, we think of Christopher Plummer as being this kindly old man, but that's only people who were born relatively recently.
Yeah, we might as well talk about Christopher Plummer, too. He was nominated for 3 Oscars. He won Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Beginners, which I don't know that film. That's it.
Again, speaking of kindly old man roles, I believe that's the movie where he came out as a much older man. I think Ewan McGregor was his son.
These are more recent films. He is Canadian. His parents had also split up. This is a common theme with these people. His parents split up shortly after he was born. He was raised by his mother in Quebec. He could speak both English and French fluently. He was studying to be a concert pianist, but would switch over to acting, and specifically stage acting. He started out at the Montreal Repertory Theater.
That's interesting that he had musical experience and they still had to dub his guitar playing.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he was a big musical star. I think he was more a Shakespearean actor. Another actor at the Montreal Repertory Theater with him was William Shatner. Interesting.
Oh, very different careers.
Yeah.
And honestly, more Star Trek connections to this movie than I would have guessed as well.
Yeah, that's true. He would make his way to Broadway, and he would perform in the American Shakespeare Festival, starring in numerous Shakespearean plays. He would become recognized as a great Shakespearean stage actor, and he started in film in 1958. He was the oldest person to ever win an Academy Award at age 82, and at 88, he became the oldest person to be nominated for an Oscar. And he also lived to be 91. Anyhow, back to what we were talking about. So we have this character, Max, who I really enjoy this guy, Max, in the film.
A very funny sleazeball. Nothing wrong with that. Every movie needs a very funny sleazeball.
He is sort of the comic... Well, there's lots of comic relief. We don't really need comic relief. This is a fun, funny movie. But he's very comical. He was played by Richard Hayden, who is a British actor, who would originally try for theater work, but nobody wanted him.
It worked out for him.
But this led him to radio work, and he would create a nasal voice character named Edwin Karp, which was very popular, and he would continue to play comedic roles using this nasal voice and this fussy manner.
Hey, Max has an incredible voice, so I guess I'm not shocked to learn that he can do
this. He did not do the nasal voice in this. He would also work in animated cartoons, including playing the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland. And he was engaged to Marlene Dietrich's daughter, Maria, for a period of time.
I mean, Maria seemed to be very beguiling.
Yes. He was an avid gardener. His friend David Niven would say he only took acting roles to pay for his huge array of flowers and plants.
Who among us?
He was also known for Young's Frankenstein. He was in that movie.
Yep. No, that was where I knew him from. Yeah.
From there, yeah. This is his actual regular voice in this particular film. So Max seems to be sort of the confidant of the Baroness, but he's also friendly with both the Baroness and the captain.
Seems like a guy very comfortable being a third wheel.
Yeah, he does hang about. He sort of admits to being a mooch off of rich people. He likes to mooch off of rich people.
He knows what he wants, and he's not ashamed to admit.
I wish I could mooch off of rich people, so I'd be there too.
Same.
But then our favorite person comes, and he's throwing rocks at Liesl's window, and the captain catches him, Rolf.
Is this the first Heil Hitler? I think this is the first Heil Hitler.
He gets all flustered. He gets all flustered when the captain catches him throwing rocks, and he says, Heil Hitler. And the captain doesn't like that. This boy, Rolf, is bringing a telegram from Max, and then Max starts talking about... Max is not very... He's an uncaring attitude about the whole invasion and stuff like that, and that infuriates the captain. He's screaming at him, and the Baroness is trying to comfort him, but then I guess we forgot to mention that all this time this has happened, he doesn't know where the kids are. The kids are missing. He was hoping they would be there for...
Even after they reconcile, he isn't the most attentive father, I would say.
No, no. But he does notice they're not there because he wants to introduce them to the Baroness. But then all of a sudden, you hear the singing and you see them rowing down the lake in the rowboat. They all stand up to wave and then the rowboat capsizes. And they said at this point, little Gretel, the little girl, she couldn't swim. So whenever they capsized the boat, Julie Andrews was supposed to grab her before she started to drown. And unfortunately, the one time they did it, Julie Andrews fell the wrong way out of the rowboat. So she fell the other way. So she was starting to drown. And Louisa had to actually get her and pick her up. And then she threw up a whole bunch of water all over Louisa.
Oh, man. Poor Gretel. The movie making in the 60s was just a different time.
Let's drown children.
Yeah, a different time where it's like, oh, no stunt doubles.
You can be bothered to make sure that Maria and knows how to play the guitar, but we can't be bothered to give the swimming lessons.
We can film this entire movie in Austria, but we can't give Gretel swimming
lessons. No, she can't have a swimming lesson. So the kids are all in a disarray. They're yelling and acting up, and then the captain blows his whistle, and they get all upset. He introduces them to the Baroness, and then the captain starts flipping out on Maria. Did I see my children? And he's asking all these questions in trees, and she's like, yes. And he's like, and what are these things? And she says, play clothes. And she tells him it's made out of drapes. And
it becomes a rom-com for
he
like...
He gets very angry. But then she starts telling him, this part gets serious. She starts telling him about how he's not paying attention to her kids and they need him. And he doesn't want to hear that. He's getting more and more angry. This is really funny. They're in this big argument and she says, well, you have to listen, Captain, or something like that. And he says, whatever, blah, blah. And he calls her Captain back. And that actually, they said that was a mistake that Christopher Plummer said, and they kept it in the, that wasn't scripted.
I'm not shocked to hear that Julie Andrews can just fluster people simply by being herself.
Yeah. That's why you see a very organic response there.
That's actually a really good fun fact.
It's a really funny part, too. And then he tells her, you're dismissed. And then all of a sudden he hears a noise. He's like, what's that sound? And she's like, it's singing. And he's like, I know it's singing, but who is singing? Why? He has to ask her that. Why doesn't he? Who else could it be?
Imagine not knowing what your children's singing voices sound like.
But who else could it be?
Awesome.
Anyhow, so she tells him it's the children. He goes into the house. And this is a really beautiful scene, too. I love the way they pan around as he comes into the room. And you see the children singing for the Baroness.
I will say that this is the moment where it was like, maybe the Baroness actually is in this for obviously not the entire right reasons, but she's enraptured by them too. It's not like she's totally immune to their charms.
But she's also, I think, very fake.
Well, yeah, she's a gold digger, but she was doing...
She's not really a gold digger because they said she was very rich too.
That's true. I'm unclear what she was doing overall, honestly, but either way, she was reacting to the kids as anybody in real life would.
Yeah. He starts watching them sing, and then as he's watching them sing, and they really do a nice job of going the close-ups onto his face on this, and he does a nice job of reacting to this. And he starts singing as well, and they all stop and look at him because they're confused. It's really a really touching, beautiful moment in the film.
It is. It 1,000% is. Again, my only note is he went from absolutely detesting music to being like, my heart is full and I'm alive again. And it just happened in the span of about
1 minute,
30 yeah. seconds, and it's a fantasy. It's fine. Yeah. But
maybe the singing reminded him and unlocked his heart.
Like, it's not subtle.
The secret garden or something.
Whatever, make the movie had to move, I guess.
Yes, but true. It was already 3 hours. We couldn't give him too long.
We're not even at intermission yet.
Yeah. The guy is this awkwardly way he invites them to hug him, and I thought that was really cool. And then Maria is now watching from the doorway. He sees her. She sort of runs off. He chases down the hallway. He asks her to stay, and then all of a sudden, everything's restored. They're doing this lovely little puppet show for the captain.
I gotta say, man, those are some of those expressive puppets I've ever seen.
Those puppets are awesome. They have professional puppeteers on hand for this puppet show.
Those puppets have to be in the Louvre, the Smithsonian. Like, they better be. Yeah, they better be preserved.
Yeah, this
forever.
Is a professional puppet show with professional puppeteers. Bill and Cora Bard, give them their credit. And the
incredible guys.
Camera angles and the cuts in this scene are very good too. And then all of a sudden, after this happens, there's this new awkward.
Very quickly,
Maria.
I just want to say Maria's increasing flusteredness. I don't think she realized what it was going to take to put on a puppet show with seven kids. And honestly, at the end, when she lets out that sigh of relief, that's one of the funnier moments of the movie.
Yeah, but don't you think actually that for the amount of time they took to prepare the puppet show, they did it quite extremely well, considering, I mean,
it's the Von Trapp kids.
How could they have done it so well within 2 minutes?
Also, they spend a lot of time and effort on a 3-4 minute puppet show, but that's another question for another day.
The yodeling is very nice, too, in that. But when the captain comes up and talks to her, all of a sudden they're very awkward. And the Baroness notices this, too. You see her giving them the eye. She's very catty.
Classic stuff.
The Baroness is very catty.
Classic rom-com stuff.
Yeah. Max tells the captain he wants to present the children as a singing group at the festival. The captain's like, no. Absolutely not.
I'm alive again, but I'm not that alive.
No, yeah. No, that's unacceptable. And then the children ask the captain to sing. He wants to refuse. And then he sings Edelweiss, which is very... Edelweiss is my favorite song in this movie.
It's a good song.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I love the way the Baroness makes a little comment to Max. Oh, I should have brought my harmonica. She's just so... Yeah.
One could say that was her wanting to be part of the music.
No.
All right. Wendy's not letting the Baroness
off
the hook.
The way she says it's quite clear that she's being sarcastic.
Correct.
This is a really beautiful scene with the kids all gathered around. The cutting again is really nice. The angles, the switching angles.
Coverage, man. This is the coverage movie.
Yeah. And then the Baroness, after that all happens, the Baroness wants him to give a party and introduce her to his friends.
That's arguably her most gold diggery moment. Yes. Even again, we've established that she's rich, but still.
She just is a captain digger. I don't know if she really likes him. I don't know what it is.
God.
And then you go right to the party scene, and the orchestra is playing My Favorite Things, and there's a lot of great camera angles there as well. The kids are outside watching, and Liesl's dancing by herself. Frederick comes up, asks her to dance. What a nice brother. That's very sweet. All of a sudden, the music switches to this Austrian folk dance. If you can pronounce the Austrian folk dance, I give you credit, because
I didn't learn a word of German when I was over there.
Sort of
I got nothing.
Yeah, it has a name. It starts with an L. I can't pronounce it. But the kids ask Maria, teach us that dance. And she starts to try to teach Kirk, and he's too small, and she can't really turn him. And then the captain comes over, and he sees her, and they start to dance together. They dance so beautifully together. And I love how the camera moves so fluidly with them. Goes from the longer shot, close up, longer shot, close up, and as they're dancing, it just moves really beautifully with them.
This movie really does spend a lot of time going from the intimate to the bigger picture. This is a weird time to clock it, but the scene when she leaves the Von Trapp house,
that's
when
one of the best.
I was like, it starts up on her by the door, then it slowly pans out as she leaves the note.
That's one of the most amazing.
I was like, it's showing exactly what she's leaving.
Yeah, and I have that, but that is one of the most amazing scenes in the film. To be
honest, I know that's jumping ahead, but it's the best example I can think of.
It is. That's an amazing shot, absolutely amazing shot. But as they're dancing and they're having this beautiful dance, the Baroness is watching them, and she don't look too happy, does she? No, I don't think she likes that. But then Maria starts to become overwhelmed. They have this part where they wind up face to face, and she gets kind of flustered, and she's like, oh, I don't remember anymore.
I almost forgot I was a nun.
Yeah, and then the Baroness comes out, and she has some little meaningful banter with Cap. He's like, it's a little cold outside. She's like, huh, I thought it seemed quite warm. She makes these little comments. This, again, the dialogue is very good. There's a lot of sarcastic undertones in the dialogue.
Again, the Baroness sucks, but she's also funny. I give Eleanor Parker credit.
She did a really good job, Eleanor Parker, with this role, to be honest. I've always thought Eleanor Parker was kind of a mediocre.
I mean, the other man or other woman is always the most thankless role in the movie, but yeah. at least the Baroness is memorable.
She did a nice job here. The kids come in to say goodnight. They do their little song, So Long Farewell.
That might be my favorite song.
That's beautifully choreographed. I love the way they choreographed that.
That's one of those just put the camera in front of them and let the kids cook.
Yeah, and they do a great job. It's a really cute song.
That's Gretel's cutest moment.
I know,
yeah.
Little Gretel. She's too cute. You just want to pinch her little cheeks.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, and I think I read an interview with Dwayne Chase where he said that. He's like, I did all of my singing in this movie except the high note, because I know the high note's always
They said
always
the high
the
note
part.
Was sung by the sister of Liesel, his high note.
Good fun fact. Okay.
That's what they said. That's what I read. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Now, every time I hear that high note, I'm like, all right.
Well, it does look different. It does sound different than the rest. Then after they leave, Max wants Maria to join the party. But then you notice the captain is acting very casual. Oh, you can join if you want. Oh, if you feel like it. Oh, you can find some clothes.
Like, I was gonna say, Maria's like, I have nothing to wear.
He's certainly not encouraging her, but that probably has something to do with the fact that the Baroness is standing there. And then you get this Herr Zeller. You get introduced to this lovely man, Herr Zeller, who if we don't like Rolf, we really don't like Herr Zeller.
Look, man, there are Nazis in this movie. Yeah, nobody who identifies as a Nazi is a good person.
But this guy is particularly bad.
This is the dude who drives the rest of the movie's like plot, basically.
Yeah, he's arguing with the captain, and I love the way this argument goes, that he could be the whole trumpet section. And he says, well, thank you for praising me or whatever. He says, well, how clumsy of me, I meant to accuse you. And I thought that was just such a great bit back and forth.
Again, our guy Ernest, whether it was him or the original book, great stuff.
Yeah, it's really good. That scene is excellent, the way they do the dialogue there. And then the Baroness is, oh, she's so helpful. She's trying to help Maria.
Yeah, then we break the Bechdel test.
Yeah, she's so nice trying to help her out, find a dress. But then, oh, by the way, Maria, didn't you notice how the captain is looking at you? Don't you know you're in love with him? Oh,
I'm a nun. I must go now.
Yeah, and so she's getting Maria so upset. And she's like, I'm going to have to leave. I have to leave, don't I? And she's like, well, you know, if you think you should.
And she even gets Maria to be like, don't tell anyone why I'm doing this. Which the Baroness is like, I mean, if you insist.
Yeah, she's like, oh, absolutely, I won't. She starts to pack. The Baroness is, can I help you? Can I get you out of here any faster? And then the Baroness tells her, Maria, you will make a very fine nun. And I just think, oh, the Baroness, oh.
Good passive aggression.
Yeah, it makes me so annoyed. She's so smug.
Eleanor Parker, though.
Yeah,
great
stuff. Yeah, it's a great job. And here's your shot, that Maria leaving the house. And this is so beautiful.
Well, you forgot the little moment before that where the Baroness goes downstairs and tells Max, basically, everything is good.
Yep,
the Baroness. I have secured our family money, as she put it earlier in the movie.
Yes, yuck. But this shot of Maria leaving the house where the camera just pulls back and pulls back and pulls back, and the music with it, it's so beautiful. And it's the end of the inner, it's the perfect
it's end. The only interior shot that made me feel that way, because obviously the exterior shots are mostly of Salzburg and they all make you feel a way, but that one I was like, there's so much intentionality and meaning behind it. And it was just, again, that's where we give Robert Wise and our Ted McCord, right? That's where those two earn.
Ted McCord.
Yeah, those were those two earn all of their money.
Yeah, and the music in that scene, too. I think the music, you might as well put the score guy in, too.
And then fade to black, and you get your gold lettering again for intermission.
Intermission.
Again, this is where I say The Sound of Music is too long if it needs an intermission with its own play-in to the second act. Yeah. I'm sorry, it just is.
And then when it comes back, and this is your point on the second half, and I think there's a purpose for it. Your point in the second half is you don't think there's enough songs and music.
It's a lot of reprises and ballads.
Yeah,
they front-loaded I'm sure the musical was like this too, but they really front-loaded this with all of the really catchy and fun songs.
Yes.
And obviously that makes sense since things get really harrowing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. But I think it was done purposely, because when you come back from the intermission, everything is going bad. So obviously you're not going to have a lot of fun, joyful songs when they're in danger.
I'm not saying it was a bad decision. Yeah. I'm just saying it makes for a less fun viewing experience than the first hour, 45 minutes.
Yeah. When we come back from the intermission, the kids are kind of half-heartedly playing this game, this ball game with the Baroness.
That entire first scene with the Baroness and Max. That's great. Great comic stuff.
Trying to do anything athletic. She's completely useless at this game.
They keep throwing the ball at her really hard. It's very funny.
And she flinches every time they throw the ball, even if it's not at her. And then the Baroness tells Max that she would send these kids to the boarding school. The kids are missing Maria. And then the captain comes in. The kids start asking him all these questions about Maria again, acting like he doesn't care.
What are they actually drinking in that scene? I was very confused.
Well, they called it lemonade. They said it's pink lemonade. But then I thought they said
that... spiked? I was very...
I think maybe there was something. Because I thought at one point she said something about it, there being something.
I just remember the captain saying something like, well, I'm brave enough to try that. Which also felt like a little mini dig at the Baroness. So,
but I thought it was funny the way he was acting like he didn't care about Maria at all. Like he could care less. Oh, didn't I tell you? She left a note. He's saying it so
nonchalantly. And by the way, here's your new mother.
Yeah. Oh, and then, yes, that's the next thing. They said, when are we going to have our new governess? Oh, we're not. The Baroness is going to be your new mother. And then they're just all staring at her in this unhappy fashion.
Is it expected, I guess, when you hear an announcement like that to get a kiss on the cheek? I was wondering about that in Austrian culture. I don't know.
Yeah. But. Well, he sort of indicates to them that they should do that. And they all go and kiss her on the cheek in the most begrudging manner. And the Baroness is just like, oh, my God. Except Kirk. He tries to sort of neck with her. But
Kurt. Our guy.
Yeah. So the kids wind up going up to the Abbey to see Maria, but they won't let her in. And then the mother abbess is worried about Maria. She wants to talk to her. Now, here's a very interesting part again. This is the very quick moment. If you don't pay attention, it's gone. But as the mother abbess wants Maria to come in and talk to her, there's a recruit there, and she's wearing this green dress. She's just literally on the screen for 1 minute, and I said, okay, come on, we're going to take you to wherever. And she goes off the screen, but she's wearing this green dress. And then Maria comes in, and remember that. Just remember that.
I totally missed this, so I'm trusting you.
So then Maria comes in. Mother Abbess is asking her questions, like, what's going on? And she pretty much tells her about the captain and tells her about she feels safe at the Abbey. She feels confused. And the Reverend Mother tells her, you have to go face your fears. You got to go back. You've got to see what's going on there. See what the truth is. And then she starts singing the Climb Every Mountain. Now,
so does she start singing that?
Well,
that
she
song?
Doesn't because, like we said, she was dubbed in that particular song. Peggy Wood, she's nominated for one Oscar, Best Supporting Actress, for this film. She began singing lessons at age 8 and would begin her career in Broadway in her teens. She would continue on in the stage in the West End, and she was a great favorite of Noel Coward. He would often create roles in plays specifically for her, and he acted with her in several of his plays. She would do some films in Hollywood and had a critically acclaimed television show called Mama, where she played a Norwegian. She was dubbed in this film, although she was an excellent singer, as she felt her voice had diminished because of her age and she could not do justice to the song Climb Every Mountain.
Okay. I mean, that's reasonable. All I will say is that Mother Abbess has about 3 scenes in this movie and proceeds to not sing that song. Why was she nominated for an Oscar?
Well, I think that her scenes are very poignant.
The scenes are very poignant. I don't know that she's the one I'm looking at in any of those scenes, considering that scene she's with Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
This is my other hot take. I'm not sure what her Oscar nomination was all about.
Yeah. The thing that was interesting about that Climb Every Mountain, she was dubbing, obviously, but they said she had a lot of trouble when she was trying to dub the beginning of the song. She was fine when she got started, but she kept messing up the dubbing at the beginning of the song.
That's a difficult song.
What they did was they had her face the window. You notice when she starts singing, she's facing the window.
Maybe it was just the TV I was watching it on or the screen I was watching it on, but I could not see her face for most of that song.
Yes,
I assume that's on purpose.
That's my next point, is that first they had her face the window so you wouldn't catch the wrong dubbing at the beginning of the song. And then you see in this... almost in most of the scene, Maria is has the light on her and the mother is in darkness. And there's one point where she turns to the side view and she almost looks like a shadow, which I think is very interesting. And I think it's on purpose.
Yeah. This is why I wanted to talk about the lighting in this movie, too, because the first act is mostly extremely bright and a lot of it is outside, and the interiors are mostly really lit. And as the atmosphere of the movie
and the
action gets darker, the lighting gets way worse. Like, even the scene where Maria and the captain finally get together, it is dark. You can barely see their faces sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. And I think part of it was the dubbing. And I think they had another purpose for putting her in the darkness, making her almost like a shadow. But only at the very end, when she comes to the window and the light comes in from the window, there's a beautiful end shot of her at the window in profile as she finishes the last notes of that song, which are so beautiful.
And to be clear, Peggy Wood is not bad in this movie. I just didn't think she was in enough scenes and made enough of an impact on me. I'm sure at the time, clearly, she was a fan favorite, but...
Yeah.
That just might. That's
now,
just
sometimes
might.
People get Oscar nominations because they had a long career or they were excellent during their career and they never really got nominated, and they like to give them a
if that's what it was,
nod at the end.
Fair enough.
So anyhow, the captain's questioning the kids about why they're late for dinner. This is a very funny scene.
These kids are so good.
Yeah, they're making up these absurd stories about berries and where they were.
The way the girls roll their eyes when Friedrich tries to explain why it made sense. They were picking strawberries.
They were strawberries because they said blueberries. He said, nope, blueberries aren't in the sea. And then he said, no, they're strawberries. They were so cold, they turned blue.
And the girls are like, you idiot.
Yeah. But anyhow, I think it's really, you can tell he's pretending to believe they're, oh, okay, well, I guess you don't need
this
any
dinner.
This
is the best fathering, I think, in the entire movie, honestly.
And then I like when he goes back and he looks back at them and he laughs.
He's like, you have one more chance.
Yeah.
Nope, no dinner for
you.
Yeah.
And then he laughs at them like, yep, outwitted you. And then this is another one of those beautiful outdoor shots at the back of the villa. And the kids are sad. And they were like, let's sing that song, My Favorite Things. And they start singing it kind of dejectedly. And then all of a sudden they hear Maria and she's coming towards them. And what is she wearing? That green dress that the recruit was wearing.
Man, I did not catch that. Yes. Good for you.
They were wearing that green dress. Did she steal the dress? Or is it because, remember, they said you have to turn in all your possessions. So that girl probably just turned in the dress. And they're like,
Mother Abbott probably made
dress.
That happen. Yeah.
Hand me down. There you go. I guess they were the exact same size. And the kids are happy to see Maria. They tell her about the captain marrying the Baroness, which obviously upsets Maria. And then the captain comes down on the steps. I love how he's on the steps and she's down. And the close-ups between them of just them looking at each other. It's very poignant.
Also good editing.
Yeah. And then the captain asks why she left. And then all of a sudden the Baroness comes down, marking her territory, I wrote, hanging on his arm. And then she says she'll only stay till other arrangements are made. But the Baroness looks a little worried about the return of Maria. And then the next shot is this beautiful shot of the captain watching Maria from the balcony. It's a really nice shot because he's close to the camera and she's far away, but yet they're both in view, like a nice deep focus shot there. Very beautiful. And then the Baroness comes out and joins him. And she's trying to make this silly kind of light conversation, this kind of silly chit-chat, making jokes. She sounds really desperate at this point, don't you think?
I mean, she knows.
Yeah,
she's known obviously
but
for a while.
Like, but she's like desperately trying to maintain some sort of this thing.
Which, again, what does she actually want? She doesn't need his money.
She wants him, apparently. She wants him.
She's not in love with him. Well, she doesn't act like somebody who's in love with him.
She is in love with him.
You think so?
Yeah.
This is one of the rare cases of somebody doing this and genuinely being in love with that person?
I think she's in love with him. I don't think she wants the seven kids, but I think she's in love with him. I mean,
I guess it's Max that's in love with their money.
Unless, of course, there's some name that she's after. I don't know. Maybe that's the only other thing.
He lives in a very nice house, so I get it.
But they said she was wealthy, so that didn't make sense. Maybe she just doesn't.
She's at least smart enough to see the writing on the wall.
And he tells her straight up he can't really be with her. And then all of a sudden she's like, stop. And then she proceeds to dump him like she's the one doing the dumping. But this is a really beautiful job by Eleanor Parker in the scene, in my opinion. I think she really pulls this off beautifully.
Again, you're right. The Baroness mostly sucks, but because Eleanor Parker is so damn charming and likable, there's just a little part of me that still is like, okay, she ultimately did the right thing.
Yeah.
She's not canceled to the level of Rolf and the other Nazis.
Well, she's not a Nazi, at least.
As far as we know.
There's a lot of great close-ups in that particular scene, too, as well. The captain seems to be surprised to realize that the Baroness has guessed his feelings for Maria. I thought he looked surprised.
Men.
And then we go to apparently the romantic scene place, the gazebo, because both of the romantic scenes have been in the gazebo. I think it's funny. I said it's interesting they would repeat the love story in the same exact place. And you have, again, the romantic blurring, the soft focus.
This is obviously much more romantic than the 17-year-old Nazi trying to woo the 16-year-old Liesel.
So he's asking her why she left and came back. She said she missed the children. He said he hopes that she would stay, and she mentions the Baroness. He tells her the engagement is off, and then he's in love with her, and they go into that song that we don't like.
Something Good isn't a terrible song. Yeah. It's just like, you didn't need a song there, honestly. That's the one part of the movie where there is music, I don't need one. And also, again, it is dark. It's obviously dark. Takes place at night, but you really can't see their faces through a lot of that. And it's interesting that they chose a romantic moment to light like that.
Yeah. There's a really beautiful scene at the end of the song. They have a lot of mist in the background, too. And then they have them silhouetted in the frame of the doorway. I thought that was so really beautiful, the way they did that. And it cuts from a long shot to a close-up. Like, they love to do that. They do that so effectively in here. And then he asks, is there anybody I should ask to marry you? And they both say, let's ask the children, which is really cute. And then you have this beautiful wedding at the Abbey. You get the church tower from a low angle with church bells. bells. You get a shot of the pipe organ going up from a low angle, which really cool.
That church, I believe, was on the Sound of Music tour I took. It's a little outside of Salzburg. Trust me, the town where it is, they make a big deal out of it. And there's a little cafe right next to it where I had the best strudel I've ever had in my life.
Oh, nice. And then her walking down the aisle, they have this high overhead shot, then this high side shot, then a close-up, and you have her whole dress. Oh, it is a magnificent, magnificent piece of work.
It was a very, very cool metaphorical shot where there's sort of a gate separating the nuns from Maria. This isn't like deep film analysis, but either way, she has to go through the gate. She has to get her entire train of her dress through the gate. Then the nuns shut it, and then she looks back, and it's very much like, well, this is your life now.
Yeah, she's left the nuns. Yeah, that's a good point. The interesting thing about when she's walking down the aisle, they start singing the How You Solve a Problem Like Maria.
Yeah, it's not funny.
It's a choir song with a very orchestral arrangement.
It's like, well, I guess we solved our problem.
And it's very heavy on the pipe organ, which is very appropriate for the church. He does a good job of making correct instruments for the occasion. Just this whole church scene is just, the camera work is so gorgeous in this. I love it. And the little changes to the top of the church tower, the ringing of the bells, and then it's sort of foreboding light, the ringing of the bells, and then all of a sudden you see the shot of the swastika on the building.
Then you're like, oh, we're at that part of the movie now. Things are about to go south.
Yeah, and the kids are at the festival site practicing with Max because Captain...
Max somehow convinced him to do it.
Captain and Maria are on their honeymoon, so he just snatched the kids and did it without his permission.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so Herr Zeller comes in, our friend Herr Zeller, and he's looking for the captain. When's he going to return? Asking him, when's he going to return? And Max says he's on his honeymoon. And Herr Zeller says, he's not in contact with his kids. And he says, well, how many men do you know that are in contact with their kids when they're on their honeymoon? Which, you know, I think that they probably would be, but okay.
Well, with cell phones, maybe. But
well, that's true.
Then,
this is back in the day. What's he supposed to do? Write them a letter? Send them a telegram.
And then postcard.
Rolf can come over. Zeller says the captain will be expected to join the Nazi party when he returns, to which Max looks very noncommittal.
By the way, it's very interesting to me that this movie is rated G when it does go into this territory. Like, this is the part of the movie. I mean, there are guns in this movie, so it's still rated G on Disney Plus, at least. So.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then also, Liesl winds up seeing Rolf. All of a sudden, he's acting very differently. He has a telegram for her father, and now we can see that he's also a part of the Nazi party, and he's not treating her very nicely.
She's giving him the eyes, and he's like, I no longer am concerned about these sort of things.
That's exactly what he says. And then the next thing we see is the captain is tearing down the Nazi flag from the front of his house.
By the way, that was a very cheap flag if he could rip that apart.
Christopher Plummer is incredible.
The Nazis were cutting corners, is all I'm saying.
Maybe Christopher Plummer is incredibly strong.
One or the other. He's a war hero.
Yeah. Just come back from his honeymoon.
As virile as he'll ever be.
But then the kids come driving up and he's pretending everything's okay. He doesn't want to alarm the kids. And then the kids tell him they're going to sing at the festival. And the captain's like, Max, I'm going to talk to you inside. Captain tells him, yeah, no, they're not singing at the festival. And Max says, it's for Austria, which...
Correct me if I'm wrong, he's also like, you have to play the game at least a little bit for your family's
sake. That's after. First Max says...
Sorry, I forgot the
order. No, that's okay. First Max says, it's for Austria. And then the captain says, there is no Austria.
It's a really sad but true statement at that exact moment in history.
Yeah, and right as he says this, Liesl gives him the telegram. And that is when Max says, you have to play ball with these people. And the captain gets infuriated
again. It is actually really interesting that Liesl is in on that conversation. At a certain point, they were like, she's old enough to handle this.
Yeah, he gets really angry again because he's like, I'm not going to do anything with these people. And then Maria and Liesl are having a heart-to-heart, and it reprises the 16 going on 17 song with alterations, obviously.
Wait a year or two.
And this is another soft focus here as well. This is a little cheesy.
It's a little... Again, I think the second half of the movie relies too much on reprises.
Yeah.
I wish it had one original banger in the second half. I don't know when it would have been. I don't know what would have been appropriate. But as somebody...
Well, I had
with,
Climb Every Mountain.
That song's also slow, if I'm being honest.
That wasn't sang before, was it?
Well, it has that, and then it... I mean,
and it has the something.
Not to spoil the end, it comes back one more time too.
It has the something good too. So yeah,
I'm just saying one fast paced song.
Oh,
that's
a fast paced song. That's what you wanted. I see. Okay.
I have a 21st century attention span. Sorry.
And then the captain wants to speak to Maria privately. He tells them basically the Nazis are telling them they have to join his army or you can die. Those are your choices. And I thought that was interesting because I bet you there are a lot of people that had to make that exact choice.
Oh no, it's not that the Von Trapps are not unique in that way.
Yeah,
they're only unique in that they got out.
Can you imagine what people had to do? Either you join this or you die.
Well, I was gonna say I'm Jewish and I had family in that part of Europe at that time.
That would have been horrible as well. But I'm just thinking of all these people sitting there living their lives and being forced to make this choice.
Yeah, I was gonna say in Germany it was one thing, but then in a country conquered by Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So they start to make their plans to leave. And then I thought it was so interesting the way they darkened the scene. They showed the outside of the house and then they slowly darken it more and more and more. Like it's going from evening to night, but all in 1 second.
And that's because eventually a very bright light is going to shine.
Yeah. And then you see Max, the captain, and Frederick pushing the car, and the kids are like, is he going to push the car all the way to Switzerland?
Gretel, again, just like batting average so high.
Yeah. And then Max is still whining about them not singing at the festival, you know, because that's the most important thing at this point. But then you see, here we are, the shot of that butler looking out the window. You know he's the one that told them. You know he's the one that tattled on them. Butler.
It's always the butler.
Yes, the butler did it.
I was going to make a Clue joke. I got nothing.
Yeah, and then you remember that the butler was probably a Nazi sympathizer, it seems like. And as soon as they get out of the driveway, the lights come on, the Nazis are standing there.
That actually makes it even funnier that Maria originally mistook him for the captain.
Yes. And then he says, what's wrong with your car? Why are you pushing it? Oh, the car doesn't start. Please go start his car. Immediately, the car starts up.
Yeah, this is where tension comes into the movie. Because at first, the only tension was romantic tension. Yeah, now we're at, like, actual suspense.
Yeah, this is actually, I even said, this is very sinister. You get a feeling of danger.
Again, why is this movie rated G? I really think this is where we have to bump it up to PG.
Yeah, because I said the sounds in this part are just, you just hear crickets. And you just get this sense of fear and danger. It's very, you really get that sense. So Zeller tells the captain he's going to take him to enlist in the Navy. And then the captain says, oh, no, we have to go sing in the festival. But Max is probably like, yay. And so Max shows him the program, said, look, they really are in the festival. And then the Nazi says, well, we'll escort you to the festival. He said, oh, that's not necessary. And he said, no, we want to, you know, we'd be happy to. And then it shows them in the festival. They're singing Do Re Mi. Again, you have a lot of different shots. You have a pan up of all the Nazi soldiers and all the different levels of the thing, which I thought was really beautifully done.
Yeah, as beautiful as a pan of Nazi soldiers.
Well, yes. I mean, it's not beautiful to see the Nazi soldiers.
No, cinematography in this movie is elite, we know.
Yeah. But then the spotlight's on Captain Von Trapp. He tells the audience, his fellow Austrians, that he will not be seeing them for a long time and he wants to sing them a love song. Then he sings Edelweiss and Then I Cry.
Unassailable. Understandable by you. This is by far the best musical moment in the second half of the movie.
Because it keeps cutting to this close-up of the captain. It cuts to the audiences and their faces. And he starts struggling to sing because of the emotion he's feeling. And Maria comes and helps him and the children come. And then he indicates the audience should sing. And then you hear all the audiences singing in unison with pride. And it's such a beautiful moment. It really is very touching. I don't know. But then,
I guess actually it's even a little bit deeper when you think about an audience that might be full of Nazi sympathizers, but also still have some civic pride.
Yeah.
It's honestly, what a pretty layered moment when you think about
it. Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of Casablanca when everybody starts singing the French national
anthem. Good call. Very good call.
So the only person, of course, that when they're cutting to him looks not happy is Harris Zeller. He doesn't particularly care for that. And I think we should stop there.
Sure. The ending of the movie only gets darker.
Yeah. I mean, most people, I think, do know the end of the movie, but I think that for the maybe the one possible person that doesn't know, let's let them
discover it. Again, it's on Disney Plus.
Discover it for themselves.
We just discussed 90% of that movie.
It is only on Disney Plus. You can find it nowhere else. Well, no, you can find it on DVD, or Blu-ray in your local library, because that's where I picked up a copy.
There you go.
So, 1 to 5.
Oh, it's a 5-star movie.
Woo!
Imagine not saying the sound of music is a 5-star movie.
I'm not going to say 5.
Okay, go ahead. Even with my criticisms of it, I would still call it a 5-star movie without blinking twice.
Well, I like it. I think it's excellent. I think there's a lot of excellent things. I would give it a 4, 4.5. I don't give movies 5 unless I think they're perfect.
Oh, you're that one teacher that will never give out an A+.
And I don't think this is perfect. I mean, I think it's wonderful. I think the cinematography is very impressive, but it is a musical, and musicals are not my favorite.
I don't know how to respond to that. Again, it's definitely too long, and I think the second act kind of has some pacing problems. Yeah. But man, that first hour and 45 minutes is just that's a perfect movie. And obviously, it needs the second act to be as powerful as it is. Yeah. But there is a perfect movie in there, and I don't feel like docking The Sound of Music a half a star.
You are here to give whatever you are.
I'm not gonna be the guy who's like, I wish the second half of The Sound of Music was lighter, even though I do.
Yeah, but that is your rating. That is why we have a guest, to give their rating and their thoughts.
I was going to say, I think I gave The Birds, like, what, 3.5 stars? Something like that.
We both gave The Birds, I think, 3.5. But
I'm shocked you gave it that much.
Yeah, The Sound of Music, I think it's great. It has brings me a lot of nostalgia from my childhood. The songs are delightful. I really love them. I love the cinematography. I love the editing. Yeah, the acting is mostly very good, but it's just, there's just something missing, I suppose.
That's
for
fair.
Me.
I think I was just that charmed by Julie Andrews, if I'm being honest. Like,
she's very charming.
Watching that movie, I was like, there's a whole generation of people who just know her as the grandmother from The Princess Diaries.
That's too bad.
I'm also, I would like to believe that younger generations are still being shown The Sound of Music. Well, but this is, I guess this is my plea. Please continue to show your kids The Sound of Music.
Yes.
They can't go through life without hearing Confidence and Do Re Mi, and they're just, the songs are so
good. So Long Farewell,
good.
Your favorite.
It's funny because that's my favorite song, and I honestly forgot the name
of
it for a second.
You didn't even say that one, I know.
I didn't say it because I hear it in my head, did not know the full name. But anyway.
Yeah, okay.
As close to a perfect movie as we're going to get.
And I agree with you 100%. Please show this to your children. Please keep these classic films going from generation to generation. These are well-deserved to be watched. You can certainly show this to your children, even with the Nazi element. This is still a very family-friendly film.
And honestly, the Nazi element is as light as a Nazi element can be. It's a good gateway Nazi movie. You know, teach your kids why they're bad, and that's also a very important lesson at a young age.
All right, so I want to thank you for being our guest today, and I hopefully maybe do this again sometime.
No, thanks for having me, and thanks for giving me an excuse to revisit some of these movies.
Yeah.
If you'll have me back, I would love to be back.
Yeah, excellent. So, for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, this is Wendy saying goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.